Yemen warning Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates that violating a UN brokered truce will trigger a painful response. The UN Human Rights Office expresses grave concerns over the excessive use of force by the Israeli military against Palestinians. At the final duel on for the French presidency, voters will decide which of the two candidates will be the next occupant of the Élysée Palace. Good to have you with us. Now, top story this hour, the Saudi-led coalition is refusing to authorize commercial flights out of the Yemeni capital, despite a ceasefire agreement in place. National carrier Yemenia says that the first commercial flight from Sana'a in 6 years has been indefinitely postponed. The plane was due to take patients in need of medical treatment to Jordanian capital Amman. The arrangement was part of a two-month UN mediated truce between Yemen's Ansarla movement and the Saudi-led coalition in early April. The airport in Sana'a has been closed to commercial traffic since August 2016, when airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition disrupted service to the city. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have lost their lives, directly or indirectly, due to the war and blockade that Saudi Arabia and its allies started 7 years ago. The country is crippled by poverty, hunger, and disease. More than 70% of the population is in need of humanitarian assistance. In the meantime, Yemen's Ansarla movement is warning Saudi Arabia and the UAE of a painful response in case they further undermine a UN-brokered truce. Spokesman Mohammed Abdusalam says that the coalition is mobilizing its forces on the Arab front, adding that Yemeni armed forces and popular committees are ready to counter any hostile act. Ansarallah and the Saudi-led coalition agreed to a two-month truce early this month. The ceasefire has been fragile, however, amid sporadic reports of Saudi attacks on Yemen. Ansarla officials also say that the coalition continues to violate the terms of the agreement by seizing Yemeni fuel ships and obstructing flights out of the Sana'a airport. The United Nations is demanding impartial and independent investigations into escalating violence in the occupied Palestine. Spokeswoman for the UN Human Rights Office is gravely concerned about the growing atrocities and the excessive use of force by the Israeli military. Ravina Shamdasani says that numerous videos have raised serious concerns about the conduct of the Israelis that's widespread, unnecessary, and indiscriminate. According to the official, many Palestinians have been beaten, shot with sponge tip bullets, and sustained serious injuries. Over the past month, Israeli forces have killed and wounded scores of Palestinians and arrested hundreds of them in the occupied territories, including at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Israeli military forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds as worshippers gathered for dawn prayers, with medics reporting that more than 40 Palestinians were injured as a result of the raid. Local sources said some worshippers were trapped inside the mosque amid clouds of tear gas, with the regime troops throwing stun grenades at them. According to the Palestinian media, at least 43 Palestinians were injured in the raid. The development comes a day after as many as 30 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces continued their violent attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds. The troops used rubber bullets, tear gas canisters, stun grenades, and pepper spray against the worshippers, who have been braving increasing aggression ordered by the Israeli regime since the beginning of the holy fasting month of Ramadan.
Right now, the site of the mosque is sacred to three major religions, but the Israelis have no consideration for anyone but themselves and their own wants and desires. So right now, when they are entering the mosque, the sacred mosque, attacking people while they're praying, worshippers are there for dawn prayers, and the IDF soldiers and the settlers are simply invading the mosque, firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds of ammunition sometimes, all to terrorize and drive them away, because they want the site completely for themselves.
The series of raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, one of the holiest sites in Islam, began last Saturday when the Israeli troops injured more than 150 Palestinians there.
Hamas has warned that continued violations of the Al-Aqsa could set off another military confrontation with Israel. The resistance movement has called for mass Palestinian mobilization in defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds City. Iran has condemned the desecration of the Al-Aqsa by the Tel Aviv regime and says it's witnessing Zionist crimes on a daily basis.
Israel's new campaign against the Palestinians doesn't stop at the occupied West Bank. On Thursday, the Israeli army carried out airstrikes across the Gaza Strip, targeting positions belonging to the resistance groups. Similar developments last year led to an 11-day war between Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The conflict killed over 260 Palestinians, including scores of women and children. The Arab League broke its silence on the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa, calling on the regime to prevent Israelis from entering the compound. In an emergency meeting in the Jordanian capital, Amman, the organization warned that Israel's actions threaten to ignite a cycle of violence, and the attacks and violations represent a blatant provocation to the feelings of Muslims. But how will such declarations help defuse the situation when, ironically, countries that have recently normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Morocco, were in attendance at the meeting? People took to the streets of the Jordanian capital, Amman, in solidarity with the Palestinians on Friday, calling on the government to expel the Israeli ambassador and scrap a peace treaty signed with the regime. Such protests have been held in several different countries. But without a unified international response to Israel, the protests are unlikely to be enough to put an end to such violations.
The international community, as you mentioned, is not doing anything about this. It's so hypocritical to see the international community condemn the things that the Russians are doing to the Ukrainians when the Israelis are doing the exact same things to the Palestinians, and their crimes are supported by the United States and other nations.
In the absence of any practical measure taken against the regime, resistance seems to be the only option.
Now, a few minutes ago, I told you about Yemeni Ansarullah movement warning Saudi Arabia and the UAE of a painful response if they further undermine a UN brokered truce. Now, to get some more information on this from Sana'a, I'll be joined by Hossein Al-Bakhaiti, who's an activist and a political commentator. Good to have you with us, Hossein. So, it doesn't seem that this UN brokered truce has been working very well, and that the Yemenis, naturally, they're losing their patience.
Yeah, it's exactly what's happening. As you mentioned, that the Saudi didn't allow in last hours a flight that was supposed to come from Amman to Sana'a and to take some ills and some Yemeni civilians who has been sick or injured by the Saudi blockade or war against Yemen. And this exactly shows that the Saudi truce cannot be held now by Sana'a forces, because as well the blockade is still on Yemen. Saudi has only allowed a handful of fuel tanker. Most of them are for the private sector, and the agreement was that the Saudi should allow 18 fuel tanker for the public sector to enter Hodeidah port. And as well, still the Saudi artillery shall continue in some areas in the border between Sana'a and Yemen. That's why I believe if the just imagine we about 24 days has gone from this truce, and Saudi did not allow any flight to come or to go out of Sana'a. The agreement said that two flights a week will come to Sana'a. This means that the Saudi till now are actually is the one who obstructing this truce, and the United Nations, especially the UN envoy to Yemen, he should be cleared and he should pinpoint who is actually obstructing this truce. But I've seen his latest statement about half an hour ago. He said that they feel concerned about the latest news about that a flight that was supposed to Sana'a was cancelled. I mean, United Nations, their statement is all about concern. But as soon as Sana'a will respond to the Saudi breach of this truce or attack Saudi Arabia, we will see all-out condemnation from the United Nations and from other country who is actually making profit from this war against Yemen.
Mr. Bokhaiti, tell us how this UN brokered truce have been of any help and assistance to the Yemenis. Has it solved any of your problems?
I mean, I think the only good thing about this truce is that the Saudi airstrike has stopped, and as well they have allowed maybe two fuel tanker for the public sector, and actually this actually has eased the fuel crisis in Yemen in general, because before the truce many hospitals were running low for the fuel. But now I think we're gonna come to the beginning of this truce. If the Saudi actually will continue its blockade, and now just imagine dozens of Yemeni civilians has come from many areas around Sana'a and other city. They have come to Sana'a, they had bought tickets, and they were supposed to go today. Many of them are children who are in need of urgent help and medical care outside Yemen. And just imagine, just few hours before the flight was supposed to come to Sana'a, it was cancelled by Saudi Arabia, and this actually adding more suffering on Yemeni civilians, because this truce actually has given Yemeni a little hope. They have lost all hope before, but now they have given a little hope. But at the end, Saudi is the one who's blocking this, and I'm sure, and I think that Sana'a response should be quick against Saudi Arabia, because Yemeni cannot take it anymore from Saudi Arabia. It has been almost 8 years of Saudi blockade, killing Yemeni civilians, and as well obstructing any deals and any truce.
Okay, hopefully things will work out. Thanks for that, Hossein Al-Bokhaiti, activist and political commentator in Sana'a. Let's now go to France. Polls are open with incumbent President Emmanuel Macron and his far-right rival Marine Le Pen fighting a final duel in the race for the top job. Some 49 million people are eligible to vote in a hotly contested runoff, with opinion polls predicting Macron to come out the winner. A victory will make him the first French president to be re-elected in two decades, but Macron saying that's not final. He's pleaded with voters to turn out in large numbers to avert a shock shift to the far right. And that's amid Le Pen's insistence that opinion polls giving Macron the lead would be proved wrong. The two also faced off in a 2017 election when Macron won by a decisive margin. Moving on, Russian forces keep pounding cities and towns in southern eastern Ukraine, with the war now in its third month. The biggest battle revolves around the southeastern port city of Mariupol, where Russia has resumed its assault on the last Ukrainian forces holdup inside a giant steel plant. President Zelensky has warned that peace talks with Moscow will be suspended if his soldiers there are killed. Meantime, in the eastern Lugansk region, Ukrainian officials say that Russian strikes on the village of Kursk have killed six civilians. Local officials say that eight people, including a three-month-old baby, lost their lives when Russia fired cruise missiles at a city of Odessa. But Russia says that the forces destroyed a logistics terminal in the Black Sea port, where a large batch of U.S. and EU weapons were being stored. Moscow also says it hit several arms depots in the northeastern Kharkiv and another central region overnight. Multiple bomb attacks on the Hazara community in Afghanistan have left dozens of families in great sorrow. The relatives of the victims are calling for justice and an end to the violence.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents, and some their children. We are meeting the family of Shahid Milad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Milad's mother can't speak, as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Milad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on the school students, Mir Hussein went to bring his son home, but he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
In the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds. These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, that's all for this news broadcast from Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Another kind of repentance is for the sins that are related to the abandonment of an obligation. It is not something that we did, rather it is something that we should have done, but we did not. My dear ones, many of us are afflicted with the last case. We should have done certain things, said things, taken some action, signed a paper, but we did not as a result of laziness, idleness and indifference towards our duty. This is a sin and we will be questioned for that. Therefore, in supplication of Makarimul Akhlaq, it is said, Help me do things for which you will question me in the hereafter. One of the things which I have sometimes discussed and which is a moving lesson for the Holy Quran is the story of Prophet Yunus. Peace and greetings be upon him. He was a great divine prophet. And remember, the Noon, when he departed in wrath, well, why was he angry? Because his people did not become believers. They did not listen to whatever he said for years. I do not know how many years. He invited them to God for many years, but it did not work, and thus he became angry and left them.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If we compare it to the abandonment of obligations that he likes for us commit, this seems no big matter. But God the Exalted questions this as well. He imagined that we had no power over him. Verse 87, chapter 21. He thought that God would not be strict with him, but God was strict with him. The reason was that he left. Elsewhere in the Holy Quran, God says, had it not been that he repented and glorified God, he would certainly have remained inside the whale till the day of resurrection. Chapter 37, verses 147 to 144. Look how important it is. If he had not glorified God, had not supplicated and had not said, glory to you, I was indeed wrong, he would have remained inside the whale until the day of judgment. There is a good news in the following part of the verse. There is no God but you. Glory to you. I was indeed wrong. So we listened to him and delivered him from distress. And thus we deliver those who have faith. Chapter 21, verses 87 to 88.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Islam's holy book, the Quran, is the theme of this expo. Held every year in the fasting month of Ramadan, the International Quran Exhibition opened its doors after 2 years of hiatus, driven by the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the 29th edition of the event has brought here exhibitors from Iran and other Muslim countries to present their religious products. While the expo displays exquisite copies of the Quran, it also gives a chance to IT firms to showcase online versions of the Holy Book, among other religious apps and software. The art section is one of the popular parts of the event. It features paintings, calligraphy works, and conceptual artworks, all themed with the Quran. The holy month of Ramadan is believed to be the month when the holy book of Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago. That's why this exhibition is held during the holy month, which is also referred to as the month of Quran.
Every Muslim family has a copy of the Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages as many times as possible during the year, and especially in Ramadan, as the month of the Quran's revelation to the Prophet. Now, one of the major goals of this expo is to promote the instructions of the divine book, especially among the younger generation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Braving the scorching heat while fasting, protesters took to the streets after Friday prayers across Pakistan to voice solidarity with Palestinians as tension continued to simmer in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli forces once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Protesters here are outraged over what they call the double standards of the international community and the way they view Ukraine compared to Palestine.
Double standards is the biggest issue with international community. East Timor, South Sudan, Kashmir, Palestine, you name it. When Muslims are victims, they will always turn their backs on us. Therefore, I think it's about time to put an end to this collective behavior against Muslims on international stage.
Actually, we are being a Muslim, Al-Aqsa, the Muslims over there are brothers and sisters. If they're in pain, we are feeling the same pain in our body. The whole Muslim Ummah is like a one body. If one part feels is in pain, the whole body feels the pain. So we are feeling that pain and we are gathered here to tell the world that they are not alone. We are with them.
Speakers at the rally stressed upon the need of unity among the Muslim world.
People are who are gathered over here because of, as you know, the situation which is going on in Palestine. Israelis are continuously terrorizing or they're attacking the innocent people of Palestine. That's why we are gathering in the protest to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Again, you know, the Jews, army and the military, paramilitary forces, they are not letting the Muslims over there freely praying and offering their rituals of the Ramadan. And everybody knows this is the holiest month of Ramadan, and this is very sacred to the Muslim.
The Israeli aggression against Palestinians has once again escalated during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by the Israeli forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque over the past few days. Mohammed Touri, Karachi.
Amid ongoing violence in Palestine, hundreds of London protesters mobbed outside Israel's embassy to condemn the regime's ongoing onslaught. The Islamic holy site in the occupied capital Jerusalem Al-Quds has been targeted with daily raids by not just regime forces, but also Zionist fanatics who seek to desecrate Islam's second holiest site during Ramadan, the holiest month for Muslims.
I struggle to comprehend how human beings can do this to others. It's occupation, but for the numbers of people that are happy to use their hate to hit and kill people, the anger that I feel and the sadness and the heartache for the Palestinians, it's difficult.
The unrest also sparked hostilities between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance fighters and Israeli regime forces as the two sides exchanged fire early on Thursday. The lack of mainstream media attention, despite the shocking footage which has emerged, has equally infuriated many onlookers.
It's not just me. Every Palestinian have been hit with the fact that international law is very selective. The application of international law depends on the interests of these countries. And, you know, the major powers insist to keep putting Israel above the law, to keep shielding Israel from international scrutiny and international sanctions. And if this does anything, it actually exposes that the world is not serious about its own rules and laws.
this isn't the first time that the Israeli regime has conducted acts of aggression against Muslims during the holy month of Ramadan in occupied Palestine. However, global awareness of Israel's crimes is at an all-time high, and with future protest action planned over the next days and weeks here in London, the global reaction to what's been going on is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
Whispers with God on a night that's believed by Muslims to be a time when their wishes are fulfilled. It's called Laylatul Ghadr, or the Night of Destiny. Muslims observe the occasion every year in the month of Ramadan, when they congregate at religious sites to pray and make wishes. To Iranians, no place is better than the shrine of the 8th Shia Imam Reza in the city of Mashhad to keep vigil on the occasion.
Words cannot describe my feelings tonight. It's a night of destiny when God has promised to listen to our prayers. It's a night which the Quran says is better than 1,000 months. I'm so happy to be in Imam Reza's shrine on this divine night.
After 2 years, we once again can visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, our beloved Imam, and that on the night of destiny. I wish that God will eradicate the coronavirus once and for all, for us to be able to live peacefully and visit our holy sites.
Islamic scriptures say Laylatul Qadr marks the night when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. The Quran says on this night, angels descend on earth to listen to the prayers of worshippers.
We believe that on the night of destiny, angels come to earth upon God's order. The Quran says in its verses that the book was revealed to the Prophet on this night, and the angels will stay on earth till dawn. That's why we never miss out on this holy night and come here to pray.
No exact date is provided for the night of destiny, but all Islamic references are unanimous that the Quran was revealed to the Prophet on one of three different dates, the 19th, the 21st, or the 23rd night of the holy month of Ramadan.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that the Night of Destiny is marked without serious concerns over the coronavirus. And this has attracted this huge number of pilgrims to the shrine of Imam Reza to once again mark Laylatul Qadr en masse and at the same time reunite with their 8th Imam after 2 years. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Violence, oppression, and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important. With the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think what I have seen, ordinary people responding so fantastically.
In the lead up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing.
Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag.
As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition, a fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, you know, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute. And, you know, they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen Civil Aviation and Meteorology Authority announced that the first commercial flight to Sana'a International Airport will start next Sunday from and to Jordan. Observers say the UN brokered agreement said there will be two flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan, and allowing one flight only is not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Announcing the start of one flight per week to Jordan is not enough and confirms there are no sincere intentions by the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the declared UN truce. There must be a full opening of Sana'a Airport and the port of Hodeidah because the humanitarian situation cannot tolerate more restrictions.
The Ministry of Health says thousands of patients, including children, are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Therefore, the United Nations should fulfill its duty and remove any restrictions on the two-weekly flights.
Yemeni patients suffer greatly due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport because they need to travel abroad for treatment. There are 30,000 registered patients in the higher medical committee, including children suffering from congenital anomalies and cancer. We demand the United Nations and the UN envoy open Sana'a's airport permanently and not for one or two flights per week, as it's not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 and imposed a closure on Sana'a International Airport. This closure has led to the death of thousands of patients, including children, especially amid the collapse of the healthcare system in the country due to the years-long Saudi war and the blockade.
Yemenis received the news of resuming the flights of Sana'a International Airport with hopes to see further flights to other destinations around the world. They say opening Sana'a Airport will save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, who are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the first time since the onset of the COVID pandemic, hundreds of people of faith and none gathered in the shadow of North London's Finsbury Park Mosque to enjoy a breaking of the fast in a public setting. The iftar, backed by the local council and organized by Finsbury Park Mosque, Muslim Welfare House and British Muslim charity Islamic Relief, was an opportunity for the community to gather, celebrate and reflect.
It's good to show solidarity, Muslim, non-Muslim, Jews, Christian, all coming together to share a meal. This is a very powerful message that we are united, we are all at one despite our differences.
It's important because it's a very visible sign of the friendship and, you know, the togetherness that we have all through the year, actually. But and it's such lovely hospitality.
For me, it's an opportunity to, I suppose, show solidarity with my Muslim sisters and also, as Pauline said, to take part in this wonderful experience.
It's no coincidence that this gathering is taking place during Ramadan, one of the most revered periods in the Islamic calendar, a time not just for abstention and reflection, but to help those who are less fortunate.
Ramadan is a time when we're always thinking about our friends, our family, our neighbours, our community at large. And I think it's one of those moments when we can all gather together, especially after the last couple of years when we haven't been able to do that.
The street iftar party was first organised in June 2017, just days after the terror attack in the Finsbury Park area on Muslim worshippers during the month of Ramadan that cost one man his life and injured nine others. The public iftar was a way for communities to show solidarity and silence hatred with hope.
Tonight, we celebrate. We celebrate the achievements of the Muslim community in this area. We celebrate and thank them for all that they do, and we enjoy a wonderful iftar supper.
This is in memory of our beloved brother Makram Ali, who lost his life in this incident, unfortunately. And we are here. We want to have it every year to, remember what's happened and try to bring community communities together after what's happened. And this is the main idea, is to bring us together, to say to those who try to divide us and spread hatred, fear and division that you will not succeed. We are together and we will be always together. Islamophobia has no place in our society, and we should all fight it.
At a time of global disunity, one small corner of North London is showing there is another way. Amina Taylor, London.
The Journalists' Union in Damascus organized a ceremony to pay tribute to journalists who were killed in battlefields while reporting on the years-long war on Syria. Officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, and employees of media outlets.
Syrian journalists had doubled the responsibility. They faced a ferocious war waged by huge media outlets on Syria. Journalists wrote their words in blood in respect of their job, homeland, and principles. We remain loyal to the blood of our martyrs.
It was unfortunately a long list of those who were killed, but a reminder of the sacrifices made for the sake of defending Syria. Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation, including one for Press TV correspondent Maya Nasser, who I proudly received it on behalf of his family.
This ceremony means a lot. It means that the martyrs are always remembered in the media outlets they work for. They sacrifice their lives for the sake of the country. We are proud of their sacrifices.
We used to miss him a lot, even when he was alive. He worked most of the time. After leaving for work for a whole month, we saw him once, and then he was killed. It's a nice gesture to honor him by the Journalists' Union.
Maya Nasser was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He was one of many journalists who was keen on being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. In Syria, tens of journalists fearlessly risked their lives, were injured or killed just to convey the truth amid a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Honoring those journalists underlines the crucial role the media plays in any war, especially nowadays. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The French presidential election is being described as a populist bloc of Marine Le Pen versus an elitist bloc of Emmanuel Macron, but many don't seem to want to join either group. The first round's third-place finisher held an internal poll. Almost 70% of his leftist supporters will either abstain or submit blank ballots rather than vote for either candidate. France's Muslims don't see a choice which isn't Islamophobic. Macron continues to support bashing Islamo-leftism, while Le Pen has an on-again, off-again plan to give fines for wearing the hijab in public. The student class isn't taking sides either. They recently blocked universities over what they say are two bad candidates. The elder class may provide the key vote. Back when he expected an easy victory, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65. Now he's backtracking in an effort to win over left-wing voters, but many aren't sure what his true plans really are.
Le bilan d'Emmanuel Macron n'est pas forcément positif.
Macron's record isn't very positive. Long-term unemployment, economic instability, the destabilizing effects of the yellow vests. People have many different reasons for being disappointed with him.
In 2017, the two mainstream parties were swept out of power, but the repeat second-round matchup has many voters upset that new ideas remain absent.
La ligne conservatrice réactionnaire.
The conservative and reactionary line is championed by Le Pen, but she's very divisive. Many of her electorate preferred Eric Zemmour in the first round, and then there are many mainstream conservatives who will never vote for her or the National Rally. The key traits of this vote are bitter abstention and bored indecisiveness.
Most polls show Macron leading by around 6 to 8 points, but that's within the margin of error, and Western polls have consistently undercounted the right nationalist candidate. The runoff is on April 24th. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
There are many security experts who claim the expansion of NATO in recent years close to Russia's borders and provocative military exercises are factors that brought about the conflict in Ukraine. Now EU members Finland and Sweden are poised to announce they want to join NATO. One analyst has been giving us his reaction via broadband.
That's a very serious escalation toward Russia, because this is when the United States will put nuclear bombs in Finland, and that would mean a direct escalation that Russia will not accept.
Finland shares a border with Russia that is more than 1,300 kilometres long. Moscow points out that if this country was to join the 30-nation alliance, NATO's land border with the Russian Federation would more than double in length. A new opinion poll by Le Soir newspaper has found that 90% of citizens surveyed in Belgium said the war worries them, but that they do not support direct military intervention over concerns that it could trigger a new world war. A quarter of those questioned said the West's supply of weapons to fighters in Ukraine is, quote, a bad thing. We have also been asking members of the public about this.
Yeah, I think we should stop doing that, huh? Because, war... fights war and then ends up in more war. So it's more about like discussing, talking.
It's a very good thing to have a dialogue with Russians and hopefully sort this out without war.
Ideally, diplomacy is the way that this comes to an end, but it takes two sides. From what I'm reading, they don't want to negotiate at all yet.
On Tuesday, the European Commission defended the decisions taken by EU governments to send arms to Ukraine.
In this case, more weapons doesn't mean more war. More weapons for Ukraine means more ability for the Ukrainian army to defend its people.
As concerns over possible escalation continue to increase, Finland and Sweden are expected to announce, before the end of this month, if they intend to join NATO. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is a dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today we will continue our previous session's topic about why is it that the Imam alayhi salam, he didn't give more money from the treasury to those who had more power to avoid a conflict. Now, we spoke last time of the way that the previous caliphs, they did their governing, shall we say, by giving more money to those that they considered of more importance. Well, when And after 25 years of such a system of governance, it came to be that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he became the caliph by people insisting that he become the caliph. And already from the first day of his governance, he started to give equal shares of the treasury to everybody, poor and rich alike. Of course, he also did help the poor people. We should stress this out. But that was from the money of the zakat and not from the Baytul Mal. Dear Sheikh, there were some points that we didn't get to finish last time. Please expand even further.
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The last point that I shared in the previous program, as you also referred to, was the fact that in some cases, Imam alayhi salam, when it comes to the poor people, he divided the Baytul Mal, the public treasury, equally for the poor and rich, for the noble companions of the Prophet and other people, for Arabs and non-Arabs, no difference. But he was, in many cases, he helped, many people, especially the poor, from, other ways like charity and zakat. It's been mentioned by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that once one of the friends of Imam alayhi salam asked him for monetary help, and in his answer, Imam Ali alayhi salam said that يَخْرُجُ عَطَائِي فَأُقَاسَمُكَهُ. You need to wait for my salary to come. This is interesting. So Imam Ali salam also somehow take his salary from Baytul Mal like any other people.
Right.
So he says that, for now, I cannot give you from Baytul Mal, the public treasury. When it is time for dividing the public treasury, I take my share from that, and then I will give you what you want from
Imam. That's the caliph of the Islamic Ummah.
And interestingly, it's been mentioned that that person said that, no, that's not enough for me, and then he joined Muawiyah.
Interesting.
And this is not only for him. We have other people that, as you mentioned also, for 25 years, they got used to this,
being privileged and being rich.
Exactly, right. Without any Islamic basis. Now, when it comes to Talha and Zubair, first of all, there is no doubt about the fact that these two people, Talha and Zubair, they, at the time of the Prophet, they helped him a lot. These two people were among the first people who converted to the religion of Islam. It's been mentioned, we know that Zubair is the cousin of the Prophet and Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he is among the first eight people who converted to the religion of Islam after Imam Ali alayhi salam and Khadija salamullahi alayha. He was so courage that he was known as Saiful Islam, the sword of the religion of Islam. Talha is known as Talhatul Khair, is again among the first people who converted to the religion of Islam. And he participated in most of the wars during the time of the Prophet. So we are not neglecting that they did a lot at the time of the Prophet. But does it guarantee the fate and destiny of the people? No. Let me give you some, historical reports about the properties that these two personalities gained at the time of the first three caliphs. So when the Holy Prophet passed away, they were just normal people.
Normal Muslims.
Exactly. When it comes to money and properties, they are just normal people. But in these 25 years, at the time of the first three caliphs, it's been mentioned that, for example, when Imam Ali alayhi salam, he came to power, after 25 years, Talha, he had hundreds of slave girls and slaves, hundreds. Right. In Kufa, he had some specific buildings, houses, which were built by specific materials on those days, which only very rich
could afford
to do that. His income from his lands in Iraq on a daily basis was 1,000 dinars. So a normal companion of the Prophet cannot have such an income unless you are given all these by the caliphs of the time.
Of course, there's a difference, just to mention how much this actually is, because we have a dirham and dinar.
Yeah.
Dirham is silver. Dinar is gold.
Gold, yeah.
So like 1,000 gold coins.
Exactly. He also had about 1,000 horses, and we know how precious one horse was at that time. It's been mentioned that when he passed away, his property was a couple of million dinars.
Worth.
Yeah. So, as a companion of the Prophet...
Like, Sheikh, as soon as you said that he had, 1,000 slave girls, how many slaves?
Hundreds of...
Hundreds. The Prophet's teachings were about freeing the slaves.
Yeah.
So you do not even need to tell me how he's going to end up, because exactly. I can already see there's something wrong here.
Yeah, there's something wrong here. When it comes to Zubair, it's been mentioned that he built luxurious houses in different cities, in Basra, in Kufa, in Egypt, and other cities. Again, when he passed away, he had thousands of dinars and, many horses and so on and so forth.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio.
You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So, this is the new character of these two great companions of the Prophet. Yes, they did a lot, but they also changed a lot after the demise of the Prophet.
Wow, that's very good said, beautifully said. They also changed a lot.
Yeah, for 25 years, I mean, their characters, their nature is changed completely. I mean, such a companion of the Prophet should not ask Imam Ali alayhi salam for more from the public treasury. But right. Now the nature has completely changed. So the point is that is it only about public treasury? No. I mean main concern of Talha and Zubair was not only to have more share from public treasury so that one may ask that Imam alayhi salam could give them more and right. through that prevent the war. No, it's not only about public treasury. They wanted to play a key role in the government of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And it's been mentioned very explicitly that they went to Imam Ali alayhi salam and, I mean, again, very explicitly asked Imam Ali alayhi salam to make them the governor of Kufa and Basra. One of them wanted to be the governor of Kufa and the other wanted to be the governor of Basra.
So it wasn't enough with economical power because they were still rich when the imami began. Rich. He didn't take their properties.
Exactly.
He let them keep their properties. But they wanted political power.
Mm-hmm. And now, this is the decision of Imam to give, the governorship of two very important cities and at that time, that is Kufa and Basra, to two people who are, not at all similar to those two companions.
They are not
of the Prophet.
Righteous, they are not just, and they do not think for the people.
Yeah.
Right.
So, if such a rich people cannot think of poor people. So right. how come Imam alayhi salam can, trust such a people?
Exactly.
And give them the power in two cities of Kufa and Basra. It's not only about these two, because at the time of Uthman, he had a kind of, interest in giving the power to his relatives and close friends and family members. And in many cities, the people in power were from close relatives of Osman or friends. And when Imam alayhi salam came to power, he dismissed and deposed many of them. It's not only about Talha and Zubair.
They were basically nepotists. They were only choosing their family and relatives. Imam alayhi salam came and said, no, it's not about who you are, what your blood is. It's about who you are as a Muslim.
Exactly. So this is the, reality about Talha and Zubair. As I mentioned, maybe we can say for sure that their main concern was not about the public treasury.
Right. It's not because they were living like poor people. They didn't have food and bread to eat.
That's the point.
Right.
Even if Imam alayhi salam gave them more but did not give them the governorship, they may do the same. Initiate the war against Imam Ali alayhi salam.
So this is actually not a conflict because of money and economics. It was actually because they wanted political power.
Exactly. And also it's been mentioned that when they come to this point that in the government, they have no share in the government of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and at the same time, according to some reports, they received a letter from Muawiyah, who also instigated them to revolt against Imam Ali alayhi salam, and gave them the promise that he will give them governorship.
The governance when he becomes the caliph.
Exactly. Right. So that was the reason that we know the story of the Battle of Jamal and the fact that they went out of the city telling Imam alayhi salam they're going for pilgrimage, and Imam alayhi salam told them that I know your true intention and the rest of the story. So it's not only about money, it's mainly about having, continuing the life that they were used to it before the time of Imam alayhi salam.
To be fair, dear Sheikh, they were already continuing the life.
Exactly.
I do not understand.
So is it possible for Imam alayhi salam to make these two people as governors of two very important cities and there is no doubt about the fact that if these two people come to power, it means that Imam alayhi salam is not with justice anymore.
Yes.
So if I may answer this question in one word, Imam alayhi salam is ready to, defend himself in a war, but protect the concept of justice. Because without justice, the whole Islamic